This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. As the GOP plows ahead with another round of budget-exploding tax cuts for the rich. Yep, that's, you know, they're talking about this right now. Let's add another $500 billion to the budget deficit. We got to make it really big, right? We've got to give as much government money away to the billionaire class as we possibly can, so that A, they can recycle it back to us in the form of campaign contributions, and B, we can use this as an excuse to cut Social Security and Medicare. This is now confirmed. Larry Kudlow said on Monday that yesterday that the White House will push for cuts to life-saving safety net programs like Medicare and Social Security if the Republicans retain control of Congress. Topher Spiro at the Center for American Progress said, believe them when they say they're coming after Medicaid and Social Security. This election is the last chance to stop them. When asked if Social Security and Medicare would be targeted for reform, Kudlow said, everyone will look at that, probably next year. Right. So here we stand. I mean, this is, you know, the two Santa Claus theory that Jude Wininsky laid out for Republicans back in the 70s, that Ronald Reagan made basically the official core of his form of governance, which is when a Republican is in office, behave like Santa Claus, spend money like a drunken sailor, borrow and spend as much money as you possibly can. Number one, all that spending will juice the economy. And number two, all that borrowing will give you something to scream about when a Democrat comes into office. And sure enough, along came Bill Clinton, and it was like, oh my God, look at the deficit, look at the debt. And Bill Clinton, you know, had a balanced budget. But still, there's so much debt. Oh my God, we've got to kill welfare as we know it. You know, and this hobby horse was, you know, this was Newt Gingrich's hobby horse, right? This is the Republicans doing exactly what Jude Wininsky recommended in 1977. When Democrats are in charge, you get them to shoot their own Santa Claus. You get them to kill off their own programs. And Bill Clinton went after the Great Society and cut back all those programs that Lyndon Johnson had used to dramatically cut poverty in this country, and poverty's been going back up ever since then. And I shouldn't, you know, I don't mean to blame this on Bill Clinton. It was, obviously it was the Republicans in Congress, they controlled Congress at that point, who pushed all this through. And, you know, Clinton just signed the paperwork and bragged that he had ended welfare as we know it. Looking back in retrospect, not such a good thing. You know, welfare, yeah, during good times, like, you know, in the 90s when the economy is really kind of in a bubble, rolling along, the tech bubble and all this other stuff, you can cut back those programs and everybody says, yeah, so what, doesn't affect me. And then, you know, the debt explosion blows up in our face, or the debt bubble blows up in our face, and here we are. And now you've got Trump putting forward, on the one hand, the lie that, look out, those Democrats are coming for your Medicare and Social Security, when the fact of the matter is that Republicans have opposed Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and all other programs for everybody from, you know, young kids to older people, all their, I mean, you know, for the length of the existence of the party, for all practical purposes, at least the modern party. And this year's budget, the 2018-2019 budget that Donald Trump himself, along with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, proposed and introduced, cuts $1.7 trillion out of social safety net programs, including hundreds of billions of dollars being cut out of Medicare and Social Security. So don't listen to what he says, listen to what he, you know, watch what he does. Because what Trump, this is the second year in a row that Trump has proposed massive cuts to Social Security and Medicare. And if the Republicans can hold on to the House and Senate, they're going to do it. Meanwhile, we see this extraordinary link between the increase in despair deaths in counties that voted for Donald Trump and the lack of despair deaths in the counties that didn't. Now, there's this debate about why did Donald Trump get elected? Why did white working class people vote for him? And I'm going to get to that in just a second. But one of the things that we do know is that despair is pretty bad in those 3,112 counties that these people looked at. This was a Columbia University study published in the Journal of Internal Medicine this week. What they found is that there's an alarming link in between the increase in despair deaths. These are deaths from drug overdoses, alcohol, and suicide. An alarming link between an increase in despair deaths and counties that voted for Trump. In the study, they said, study leader Lee Goldman, chief executive of Columbia University's Irvine Medical Center, said, although life expectancy is increasing in many parts of the county, especially in urban areas, we're not seeing nearly the same gains in rural and middle America. We shouldn't underestimate the degree to which some portions of the country have been left behind in terms of their health. And they looked at all these counties, and the deaths caused by alcohol, drugs, and suicide was 2.5 times higher in 2016 in those counties. They suggest possible improvements in life expectancy in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin could have shifted votes to Secretary Clinton. I'm not sure, because Glenn Thrush in the New York Times a week or so ago, writing, it's I'm going to get to that one in just a second. This one is by Mehdi Hassan. This is in The Intercept. Time to kill the zombie argument. It's not economic distress that drove white people to vote for Trump. Economic distress is part of the equation. But the main part of the equation on a 2-to-1 margin was racial anxiety, or the fear of being displaced culturally and socially. In other words, brown people come in for my job, black people come in for my job, somebody from another race or country might want to marry my sister or my wife or daughter, you know, fill in the blanks. I mean, this is, you know, the big question. Why do white working class men vote for Donald Trump? The study says this whole thing about economic anxiety, complete myth. They say it has more to do with cultural anxiety and racial resentment. And then they listen to Donald Trump slamming black athletes as, quote, sons of the B word, or Elizabeth Warren as, quote, Pocahontas in front of cheering crowds. And you get it. He's talking about race. There have been 4 different studies on this now. The first was published May of last year in the Atlantic magazine. It was done by Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI. And what they found was that financially troubled voters in white working class were much more likely to prefer Clinton to Trump. So people who were having economic problems, people whose mortgages were underwater, people who were, you know, in dead-end jobs, people who just lost their jobs, they voted for Clinton over Trump, substantially. So who voted for Trump? The study says, quote, it was cultural anxiety, feeling like a stranger in America, supporting the deportation of immigrants, hesitating about educational investment. Those things were the best predictors for support for Trump. White working class voters who expressed fears of cultural displacement were 3.5 times more likely to vote for Trump than those who didn't share those fears. That's the first study. The second study was published in January this year. It was done by 3 Amherst University political scientists. And they asked the question, what caused whites without college degrees to provide substantially more support to Donald Trump than whites with college degrees? And this is right from the study. This is a survey of 5,500 American adults. We found that racism and sexism were strongly associated with vote choice in 2016, even after accounting for partisanship, ideology, and other standard factors. These factors were more important in 2016 than in 2012. Now, I would say that was because in 2016, we had just finished 8 years of a black president, and the unrelenting outrage poured upon him by Fox so-called news, right-wing hate radio, et cetera. Anyhow, back to the study. Study suggesting that the explicitly racial and gendered rhetoric of the 2016 campaign served to activate these attitudes in the minds of many voters. Indeed, attitude toward racism and sexism account for about 2/3 of the education gap in vote choices in 2016. Third study, Stanford University, April. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Sciences. Living in an area with a high median income positively predicted Republican vote choice to a greater extent in 2016. In other words, the wealthier you were, the more likely you voted for Donald Trump. And those people working with a worsening personal financial situation, worsening, drove working class voters into the welcoming arms of billionaire property, of a billionaire property mogul, Donald Trump. Those who felt that the hierarchy was being upended. The major thing, though, that found that people would vote for Trump were those who felt whites were discriminated against more than blacks, a familiar trope from Fox News, who felt that Christians were discriminated against more than Muslims, another familiar trope you'll see on Fox News, and men who were who believe men are discriminated against more than women. Those people who share those three beliefs almost consistently voted for Donald Trump. And then the latest, you know, study that was just published, co-authored by George Washington University political scientist John Sides, found that the prevailing narrative of the 2016 election focused heavily, quote, on the economic concerns of America, especially the white working class. That is flawed and misplaced. He said, this is from the study, what was distinct about voter behavior in 2016 was not the outside role of economic anxiety, but attitudes about race and ethnicity, which were more strongly related to how people voted. Trump voters in 2016 do not report more economic distress than do Clinton voters. If anything, the opposite is true. The political implications of economic distress are mostly negative for President Trump. So it wasn't the economy stupid, it was race stupid that got Donald Trump elected, according to these studies. And this is pretty important stuff that, you know, we need to be paying attention to and taking seriously. So we got more of the news of the day, plus your calls, coming up in just a few minutes, so stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bottom line, why do you think people voted for Trump? And do you think that racism enough is going to be enough to sustain him and the Republican Party through this election? And welcome back, Jordan, watching Free Speech TV in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Jordan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today? Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. What's up?
I want to talk about Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still struggling with Social Security, and I know we have a president that's trying to help people who are struggling.
We have a president who's trying to help billionaires who are struggling.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts about that?
About what?
For me.
What's your struggle here, Jordan?
It's just my Social Security is just messed up in ways that I can't really understand.
How old are you?
I'm 18.
So you're not receiving Social Security?
No.
So how is it screwed up?
I just really need help with it, and I don't know if you...
Well, you don't, you know, there's two ways to get money out of Social Security. One is to be disabled, and then you qualify for the Social Security Disability Insurance, and that's any time in your life at any age. And so I'm assuming you're not disabled. And then the other way is to be over 67 years old and retire. It used to be 65. Reagan raised the rate to 67. And then you get the Social Security retirement benefits, and you're eligible at 65 now for Medicare. Throughout your life, you have to pay 2 or 3% of your income into the Social Security Disability Fund, but that's taken out in your paycheck. So, are you struggling with, you know, the politics of it that you think, you know, it should be cut like the Republicans want to do, or it should be expanded like Democrats want to do, or, you know,
expanded like Democrats want to do?
Yeah. Okay.
Because I'm a Democrat myself.
Okay. Well, you know, the way to do that is to elect people to Congress who say that they're going, which is the Democratic Party, basically, who say that they agree that they want to see Social Security expanded. Jordan, thank you for the call. Good luck with that. I applaud what you're doing. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How's it going? I got two quick things to say. No, racism is not going to save the Republican Party. It's going to be their death knell. And yesterday, Ken Starr, Bill Clinton did not commit perjury. Bill Clinton, what he did was he asked them to define sex. B- BJ was not in their definition. So he said, by your definition, no, I did not have sex.
Right.
So Bill Clinton did lie to the American people, but he did not commit perjury. He just was a smarter lawyer than the Ken Starr team.
Well, he was convicted of perjury. So whether you and I think he committed perjury or not, a court ruled that he did, and he lost his law license because of that. So, that's
railroaded.
Yeah, and that's such an old argument. What I don't get is how Ken Starr can run around as he did yesterday on this program and defend all this salacious obsession on Bill Clinton's private parts and his private sex life. When they were unable to find him.
They didn't want another Kennedy.
Say what?
They didn't want another Kennedy. Clinton's had the potential to be Kennedy's.
Yeah.
They didn't want that to happen.
I think you're right. Yeah, they didn't. Well, sort of. I mean, it wasn't quite the dynastic family, but yeah, it would have been Bill and then Hillary and then maybe even Chelsea, and they wanted to put a stop to that. I got that. Paul, thanks. Thanks for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So let's stick a stake in the zombie argument. Trump won because there's a number of racist white people out there, and quite a few of them are basically afraid. Sure, there's some economic anxiety, but the economic anxiety exacerbates the racial anxiety. It makes it worse. Meanwhile, it just continues to roll, right? Paul LePage. Now, this was about a month ago that this happened, but it apparently slipped by my radar here, and I think it's worth coming back to revisit. The ACLU of Maine is pointing out that black people and white people in Maine, even though there's so few black people in Maine, black people and white people are equally likely to be using drugs. This from medical studies. But when you look at the legal studies, black people are much more likely than white people to get arrested. Now, could that be because the governor of the state, Paul LePage, is referring to black people as the enemy? And of course, the police are paying careful attention to what he says. Here's his quote. He says, look, a bad guy's a bad guy. I don't care what color it is. When you go to war, if you know the enemy dresses in red and you dress in blue, you shoot at red, don't you? You shoot at the enemy. You try to identify your enemy. And the enemy right now, the overwhelming majority right now coming in, are people of color or people of Hispanic origin. I just can't help that. I just can't help it. Those are the facts. Right. If you go to war, you shoot the enemy. According to the governor, this is from the ACLU. According to the governor, Maine police are 9 times more likely to arrest people of color for selling drugs than white people, even though white people are just as likely to commit drug offenses. This alarming disparity in arrests raises significant concerns that Maine law enforcement is participating in unconstitutional racial profiling. Speaking of Maine. Actually, speaking of perfidy on the part of Republicans, Betsy DeVos, this from Glenn Thrush in the New York Times, after scaling back student loan regulations, administration tries to stop state regulations. Glenn Thrush writing for the New York Times, after the Education Secretary Betsy DeVos started scaling back consumer protections for student borrowers last year, 6 states and the District of Columbia, they tried to put into place laws to protect you from being ripped off by a student loan company. And now the Trump administration, but now Ms. DeVos is trying to stop them. Now the Trump administration is supporting a lawsuit from the Student Loan Servicing Alliance. This is the lobbying group for the student loan industry against D.C. creating a student loan ombudsman office. It's amazing. They're trying to shut down the city of D.C.'s efforts to protect student borrowers in the district.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Because, of course, the Trump administration doesn't give a rat's ass about students or the people with the loans. They just want to make sure that the rich lenders are taken good care of. There we go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the crackling has stopped. That's cool. Okay, there's all kinds. I've got such a pile of news here. And other things, but if this was all about it, the final point I want to make, and I think that this is probably the big point that I should have made at the very beginning, not only with regard to gutting the Social Security, Medicare, the social safety net, things like that, this is killing America. I mean, it's literally killing American citizens, as you heard my talking about the despair deaths. And if, in fact, the people who voted for Donald Trump did so because he was using racist and sexist language, then if Tom Arnold is actually able to roll out a tape of Donald Trump using the N-word in a pejorative way on The Apprentice, it's probably going to help him with his base, right? So what do we do about this? I mean, how do you deal with a guy who can't be shamed? I mean, who thinks Nazis are very fine people? It gets very strange. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I am shocked sometimes when talking with people. I'm not a social scientist, but I'm a healthcare professional. You know, how some professionals actually fear other professionals coming in from other countries and taking their jobs. And I've heard an artist who is quite famous, I can't mention her name, but who became famous by painting American Indians and gay men, she expressed this view that New York City is being ruined, quote unquote, because of all these foreigners coming in and destroying all this great European culture. So, it's really interesting that people are so afraid of the other. And I don't quite get that, especially coming from people who are on the liberal side of things or, at the very least, very educated people.
I think it's very easy to understand what's happening, I believe, is that white people are beginning to understand what white privilege is.
Right.
They're beginning to realize that they have had advantages literally from the day that they were born, that those advantages accrue to them in a whole variety of different ways, from in terms of safety, income, education, social capital, political capital, financial capital, all those things. And now you've got the Pat Buchanans of the world are starting to be, Pat Buchanan has been singing this song literally since the 1960s.
Yep.
The brown people and the black people are going to take your money. They're going to take your wealth. They're going to take your slot in college. They're going to take your job. And in other words, it's not just, oh my God, I have competition. It's affirmative action is actually going to put black people ahead of you, above you.
Right.
They're going to have black privilege now, and white privilege is going to go away. That's what's got white people freaked out.
Right. And what's interesting in this artist's case, her parents are Jewish, her grandparents were Jewish, and they were discriminated against in New York. You would think that people from that kind of background would be even more sensitive to the fact that, they also suffered, some discrimination in achieving what they have achieved in this country.
Oh, and some are. I mean, George Soros is probably the leading example of that, but there are many others. But there are no boundaries for fear, which is what drives this, and for the hate that comes out of fear, John.
Mm-hmm.
There just aren't. John, thank you for the call. Very, very well said. Martin in Seattle. Hey, Martin, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Good morning, Tom. Long time listener. Very long time listener. First time caller.
Thank you.
And strangely, it was the first time I called was stimulated by your statement that Social Security starts at 67. The last I checked, it starts at actually 62. If you want to take an earlier retirement and a smaller check,
that's correct.
If you wait till you're 65, it's a bit bigger. But unless you're going to, you know, your date of death usually doesn't pay out unless you, you know for sure you're going to live beyond 78.
Yeah.
So, but you actually, while I've got you on the phone, motivated me to take social action in a way that I hadn't before, and I want to thank you for that.
You're welcome. What'd you do?
I mean,
if I may ask.
There's an organization in Washington State called Washington Public Campaigns, who are now called Democracy First.
Mm-hmm.
I was stimulated to take part in just volunteering, and they voted me as the chair.
Wow.
Of the Pierce County chapter. So, and this was at the time when Citizens United passed our Supreme Court. So it kind of shot down our efforts to get money out of politics at the time.
Mm.
So what do you think is the current state of our changing or actually amending the Constitution to get money out of politics?
It's growing. We're in the neighborhood of 20-some-odd states now that have essentially said that if such an amendment comes before their legislatures, they would ratify it. There's two ways to do it. If we can get enough states to say yes, then it forces Congress to vote on it, or if Congress votes on it, then it gets thrown to the states, which is how it's done typically in every other situation. And the third way is to call a constitutional convention, which is what the Koch brothers are trying to do, but that's to rewrite the whole Constitution. I think that's a very dangerous thing. But, you know, the effort is rolling along, and I believe we're going to be getting Caitlin from Move to Amend back on the program here soon. It's just a matter of working out exactly, you know, what we're going to be talking about and where they're at in their campaign. But it's a solid one. Martin, thank you for the call. You've raised some good and important issues. Miriam in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Miriam, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am originally from Kazakhstan. I grew up there and then moved here, got married. And being biracial, I've been experiencing different attitudes from different people depending how they perceive me. Mm. I'm half European, half Asian. Mm. Sometimes people take me as Hispanic. And it depends how they perceive me. They treat me differently. So,
for example,
At first they kind of like distant and kind of cold reception.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start speaking, they see that I don't have the Hispanic accent.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of like, oh, she's kind of like with accent, like more like a white type of accent.
Mm-hmm.
They start like being more open and talking to me more and, sharing their life with me more, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And also, I have a child with autism, and I also experienced discrimination because of being a foreigner on her as well.
Hmm.
So we had a neighbor who had some mental problems, and she decided to call us as if we stole the bicycle from her daughter.
Oh,
and
no.
I was trying to explain to her that it was not true and talk nice to her, but she was escalating so and told me to call the police. So I called the police, but the police, I was trying to explain the situation, what happened, but they took the side of her because she doesn't have an accent.
Mm.
So while I was trying to explain that I have documents to prove that it's our bike because I purchased it online.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the receipts, and there is a print, like a code number on the bike that matches the receipt.
Right.
Luckily, I had that bought online.
So you were able to prove it. But the bottom line here, yes. Miriam, is that you're saying that your experience of living in the United States
mm-hmm.
is that race is a big factor in just your day-to-day quality of life.
Right. Yeah. It impacts not only me, but my child who was born here, and her dad is American, and I see that kind of impacting her life as well.
Yeah. Okay. Miriam, thank you for the confirmation and for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it. Edgar in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Edgar, what's up?
Hey, Tom, a long-time listener, first-time caller. Yeah, with the question in regards to will race carry the GOP over, I think it plays in their favor in the American psyche because being an immigrant from Nicaragua, me and my family migrated here because of the war that was going on in the 80s. I learned here in America there's a propensity just to really fear the other and either through the media, propaganda, and the way the whole capital system is set up, is that any mention of another is just automatically triggers, it's almost like an instinctual reaction to fear, to hate, dislike. And the Trump presidency encapsulated that, I think, perfectly. Although I would say in the primary, he did play that populist role really well because he did touch on things that Clinton didn't want to touch because of her establishment record. As far as talking against the wars, that some of the wars that the United States have been on have been just crazy. The poor people here are not being taken
Clinton,
care of.
Clinton criticized the wars and apologized for her Iraq vote. But you know, I get your point. And he also lied. I mean, you know, he said, well, I'm going to get everybody in the country health care and it'll be cheaper than Obamacare. I'm going to protect your Social Security and Medicare. I'm going to bring the jobs back. You know, every single one of these things were lies. And
you know,
I mean, he's not even the tariff policy, which is something with which I agree, is not being done right. He's doing it by presidential directive using the rubric of national security, which means that it's going to go away in a couple of years. Nobody is going to build a factory in the United States, you know, because of these tariffs, because they're not
right.
Long-term or permanent. I mean, it's just the whole thing is pathetic the way he's doing this.
Snake oil salesman. But I think, you know, this is the failing of the Democratic Party, because he played on those real economic anxiety the voters had, especially going against the TPP.
But principally, yes, and he got votes for that. And there are, you know, and there are some good Democrats, you know, Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders out there going, yeah, we need a tariff-based trade policy. We need a rational trade policy, but not one done by executive order. This is just being done the wrong way. And of course, on those other things, Trump simply lied. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's 46 minutes past the hour in the place where despair is not an option. And welcome back, Don in Portland, Oregon. I believe listening
there,
to our
Tom.
Pacific affiliate, X-Ray FM. Hey, Don, what's up?
Oh, it's good to talk to you, neighbor.
Thank you.
I love the calls you've gotten this morning, but I wanted to address the pathology that's behind the racism and all the other stuff. And I think of it as patriarchal culture, the boss and the slave owner, the person who pays at least as possible, and they're extractive, and they're dominators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the things that a patriarch can't stand are sexual deviation and abortion, because it's his fetus.
Right.
So I think these are old historic memes in that sense. And so the white man's burden, which is killing their souls, is the problem. And they can't figure out that, you know, they've been trained to do this. They've been given approval by church and local culture, and all of a sudden they're told they got to go to therapy. I can see why they're feeling angry about the way history's going, but I would love to relieve them of that burden and help them become human beings. It's so much more fun. I gave up being white a while back because I had some real great experience. I was called black, even though I have the most Irish white skin you'll ever see.
I don't understand.
I was playing in a band in Indianapolis with all the black people, and in the second year they told me I was black, and they convinced other black people that I was black. It's
like
crazy.
Like you were just, like you had black parents and you were the anomalous birth kind of thing?
I was the whitest guy in that band, and believe me, it's a negative contrast. But I was told, and then Hazel, my band leader, convinced black people in Indianapolis that I was black. It was about how I behaved.
So how did that change how you were treated, Don?
Well, I realized that what I wanted to be was a European American, because that's honest.
Mm-hmm.
And to be white is to participate in the dominating power construct. If that's your identity and you are defending whiteness mm-hmm. rather than your own true ethnic background,
right.
then it's strictly the power thing. And it is going to be racist, and it's going to be sexist, and it's going to be homophobic, and it's going to be imperial.
Yeah. I would argue that these things don't just grow out of what you're defining, but they actually grow out of monotheism itself. When you accept the idea that the entire universe was created by a man with a penis who is all-knowing and all-seeing, the ultimate father figure, you are buying into a patriarchal authoritarian worldview that starts at the very largest chunk possible, right? The creation of everything. And then carries all the way down to the smallest unit possible, like, you know, the family or the workplace, where, again, it's, you know, the patriarch is the guy who's in charge.
No, I agree. See, I'm a retired Presbyterian minister, so I do know the history of patriarchal culture. But one of the things that I look at in the gospel is the deconstruction of patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Paul tells men to act like women. He can't say it exactly that way, but he says be mutually submissive to one another.
Mm.
Jesus is a great feminist. So you don't get images of patriarchy in these guys. And
I think maybe with Paul. but they sure
Paul
did. They sure did.
Writing in context, and there are three of them to begin with. It's not just one Paul.
Yeah, but they sure did change that after the Second Council of Constantinople. Anyhow, Don, thank you for the call. I love discussing religion and culture and patriarchy, and he's spot on all of it. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 9-8 minutes before the hour. Just a quick heads up, Michael Moore's new movie 11-9 is hitting theaters on Friday, and Friday night Michael Moore and I will both be on Real Time with Bill Maher talking about that. Well, he'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about whatever they decide to talk about. And I think it's going to be, you know, a very, very interesting time. So anyhow, let's see here. Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Ken, it says you want to disagree with me. What's up?
Well, with those reports, I want to disagree. It's, you know, when you look back at being racism for Trump, I look back at a number of the key counties around the country that voted for him. They all voted for Obama 4 years earlier. And
we're talking about a 3 or 4 point swing in some cases as much as a 6 or 7 point swing. But typically it's been a 3 or 4 point swing between the two. So, you know, that's not proof of some major trend.
Well, but, you know, the idea, I know these people. I'm one of them, a working man. And I've seen the jobs, you know, I've seen the construction industry decimated by crews of illegal aliens coming by. You bid a job for $20 an hour, and they come in and they pay their people maybe 8 or 10.
You know, no, you're absolutely right. One of my brothers worked in construction trades his whole life, and I saw this up close and personal. But that doesn't mean that the people with the brown skin are the ones who are the villains in this morality play that you're living through, Ken. It's the white, rich people who lobbied Ronald Reagan to stop enforcing our immigration laws, who have kept those changes in place. I mean, you know, prior to Reagan, we used to put employers in jail. That's why, you know, we never had an illegal immigration problem in this country prior to prior to 1986. But Reagan was lobbied by the so-called Main Street Republicans, the small business Republicans, and they said, we want to be able to hire people at less than minimum wage. And particularly in the meatpacking industry and particularly in the construction trades. And so Reagan said, fine, I'll stop busting people. And boom, you know, what happened was an absolutely predictable thing that happened. But your problem isn't with people of color. Your problem is with people whose skin looks just like you, who just have a hell of a lot more money than you do.
Well, I know that's exactly it. But you see, Trump exploited that. And he said it was the color. And
I agree.
The point is, these people, they want their jobs. It's economics. It is economics. You know, you can't go back to this Clinton narrative that is sexism and race. Not the economics. We got to get back on economics. That will solve so many of the problems.
Okay. Well, your opinion is registered. It doesn't comport with three different scientific studies, but your opinion is registered. Kim in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Kim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I follow you avidly. I think you're awesome. I know people here in Oklahoma who absolutely voted for Trump because they are racist, and they liked that about his message. But I'm also absolutely certain that a great number of people voted not necessarily for Trump when they cast that Trump vote, but against Hillary Clinton. And I think that was easily foreseeable by the Democrats, and it should have been addressed long before. Now, I don't know if this is because of all of the right-wing conspiracies that were put forth, or if it was because of her TPP positions, or if it was whatever. I mean, George Stephanopoulos was on a show called The Clinton Years on Frontline, PBS, and he was talking about a dial drop for Clinton just from her entering a room. You know, so this is something that's been known since at least the 90s, and I'm wondering, what was the purpose in putting her forth as a candidate, knowing how terribly unfavorable she was?
Wow. You know, that wasn't my decision.
Of course,
I mean, it was, I suppose, collectively all of our decisions, in that there was a primary, and she did win the primary. But the primary, as, you know, ask any Bernie fan, the primary was not done in a way that I think was fair. But you know, Hillary Clinton, in many ways, looked like a great candidate. She had been Secretary of State. She did an extraordinary job. As First Lady, she did an extraordinary job. There was all this right-wing noise around her.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the main baggage that she was carrying that hurt her was her husband's policies, which were mm-hmm. popular at the time and are no longer popular. The DLC stuff, the NAFTA stuff, the TPP stuff, all those things. And Trump went right after that.
I just find the racist excuse, although I absolutely believe it, because I see it around me, I hear it around me constantly. I think if we put too much weight on that sort of thing, we're ignoring the obvious. And, you know, the margins that this was won by, clearly she was the popular vote winner.
Yeah.
There was no mandate for Trump, and I think the numbers show that.
I agree. I absolutely agree. But, you know, asking the question, what was it that pushed him over the top? What we find over and over and over again is it was not economic anxiety. It was, in fact, the majority of the people who voted for Clinton were the ones who were economically anxious. It was race and class and misogyny. Kim, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.